You've heard me talk about Morning Kick, used by former karate champion Chuck Norris. It's a daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes similar to strawberry lemonade, and I enjoy it. I know I don't eat as many vegetables as I should, but Morning Kick has helped me make up for that, and I feel great. I have more energy and better digestion. It's an easy part of my morning routine. My wife started taking it as well. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris today. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Conversations That Matter podcast. And I am sorry. I need to apologize to everyone for the tardiness here on the live stream. It's about 19 minutes after when we were originally going to start, and I've just had a bunch of issues. I was traveling over the weekend, for those who don't know, and getting my camera back set up. I was having some issues with it, and then I had some internet issues, and I also got a cold. So I've got a bunch of things stacked against me, but I really, really wanted to get a video out there for all of you, just to talk. And I don't think we're going to answer every question necessarily, but just to talk about what's taken place over the last 2 days on social media, mostly Twitter. At times like this, I'm grateful that I don't have a Twitter account anymore, a personal Twitter account to join in, because I'm glad that if I make a comment, it's in the context of this live stream or video where I can qualify it. And I don't know. Academics, I think, like that kind of thing more. They're long winded. Has anyone ever accused me of being long winded? I think they have. So this is what we're going to do today, though. We're going to go through a number of things. I'm going to show you some screenshots and everything, and then we're going to have a long form conversation about it. And there's already some people lined up to ask questions or make comments about this. Tonight joining me is David Morrill from Protestia. Thanks, David. Say hi to everyone.
Thanks for having me. Well, it was funny. I had a one of my patrons messaged me because I just linked your live stream in Protestia's Patreon, and they're like, "Oh, good. I was wondering how I was going to watch both live streams at once, because I usually go live at Tuesday about this time." So it's like,
so you're giving up your live stream to be on my live stream? Is that what's happening?
Well, your live stream is much, much bigger than mine. So yeah, totally.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. I mean, we'll both do it together then and just talk about some of these things. I saw the longer tweet. What, by the way, I just got to ask, this is my own curiosity. What's up with the longer tweets, which is a good thing, I think, but what is that a new feature that must?
It's a feature for those that are actually paying for Twitter, like paying for Twitter Blue. So if you're $8 on Twitter, you can write, you know, extended tweets. The first 280 or something will show up on the timeline, and everything else will be via more link there. So yeah,
I like that. Well, you had a good thoughtful take on this, and there's very few thoughtful takes on the controversy right now. So hopefully this podcast will be one of the places you can go for a thoughtful take. I want to start here with, I made a little slideshow with just some of the relevant tweets. And I want to start before the firestorm. I thought this was going to be the big controversy, but it was overshadowed. But I don't want to forget about it. So this is a series of tweets from Josh Bice, who's the president, I think, or the director, founder of G3 Ministries. And he put a bunch of things out there, mostly over the weekend. I think all of these are from Sunday and Saturday and Sunday. I'll just read one of them here. Even if you could baptize America, it still wouldn't make America a Christian nation. The theological arm of the Christian nationalism debate is extremely flawed. Nominal Christianity is not Christianity. Carnal Christianity is not Christianity. Our aim is Christianity. And then Stephen Wolfe responded and say, are you responding to actual arguments or arguments of your imagination? And I think that was the first one I saw. And then, of course, there was a number of tweets where the insinuation was at least present that Christian nationalists would want to elect appoint a Protestant pope or something of that nature. And it's integralism, which is a Roman Catholic movement, essentially, or it's a form of integralism or includes aspects of that. So anyway, this is where I see this whole thing starting in context, and I like historical context. I mean, I don't know if you agree with me, David. Is that where you see this whole thing starting too? Is with this sort of taking aim at Christian nationalism?
I suspect both sides of where the debate is currently have been trying to, you know, sort of establish their footing and what sort of where they stand on this, you know, in private. And then, you know, what happens on social media, stuff gets blown out in the open every once in a while.
Right.
You know, it's like the article I'm working on right now, I think I described it as, it's kind of in some degrees a heady theological debate that every once in a while has a little thunderstorm that hits the ground on Twitter and everybody gets mad at each other and starts throwing barbs back and forth. And so I always hesitate to even jump in because I have, as you know, I have, you know, friends and people who I respect as brothers and as theologians on both sides of this conversation right now. But I feel like a lot of people talking right past each other.
Yeah.
And it's usually like definitional confusion makes us talk right past each other and we can't ever get down to the debate. And of course, social media makes it all the more tribal, you know?
Yeah. It grieves my heart. I hear that in your tone there too, that this is, I've gone through a bunch of emotions looking at some of the things that have been written. I've had anger about the snap judgments and the failure to give the benefit of the doubt to some, as we'll see in a moment. I've been sad about it. I think I'm more sad than anything. And I want to see unity, especially on the side that didn't want to go completely down the woke hole. Now we're splitting. I'm not saying that I want to split. I'm just saying, I'm calling it what it is. That's what it looks like. What's happening is that we are splitting into at least two different groups, probably more. So it's more of a splintering if it's more than two. You're seeing that, I'm assuming, the same thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I have conversations with, you know, with you and with others that are more sympathetic to Christian nationalism, and then on the other side, I have conversations with folks that are very much focused on maintaining individual liberty, religious liberty, things like this, and they see some of the Christian nationalist side of the debate wanting to reduce or even eliminate, you know, some of the components of individual liberty, or at least its moral imperative, and then the other side. You know, I would argue in some ways being, you know, not very committed to culture, being true culture warriors in the current conversation. And the funny thing is, I really think, and maybe it's just me being a, you know, an optimist or something, which I realize, okay, protesting, we wouldn't be optimists. Like people wouldn't think we're that, but I think there's common ground. I mean, I think especially in terms of, you know, some of the doctrinal underpinnings, but also what we're even to do in the United States of America.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So what I'm hearing, and I've heard this from, even William Wolfe was saying this recently, that, I mean, he's saying these guys are winnable. We have common ground. It's just a misunderstanding. There's ignorance. I guess my cynic says that I'm not as optimistic on that, but, the thing that concerns me about this, the way that this whole thing started, is it's not just that there's a misunderstanding. It's a bad misunderstanding. It's a caricature. I mean, I read Stephen's book, and I also read Andrew Torba's book, which are the two big ones, I guess, on Christian nationalism. And you don't find anywhere in there anything about a Protestant pope, right? You don't even find the word integralism in any of this. I can understand people who are concerned that they don't want an official church or something like that, but this is going way farther than that. And when you caricature the other side, that makes for resentment. That makes for you're just mudslinging at that point. It's not an actual debate. I think, as you pointed out, David, it just becomes people get into their tribes and then no one's talking to each other with actual definitions. I'm not going to read all of these, but I just wanted to point out that this became somewhat more than just Josh Bice. You had even Scott O'Neill saying that the Plymouth Colony's Mayflower Compact was unbiblical because it said the founding of their colony was for the glory of God and an advancement of the Christian faith. Gabriel Hughes taking aim at Stephen Wolfe's book, Andrew Walker taking aim at Christian nationalism, And this was all happening. And then we get to the infamous tweet, and this is probably where we'll spend a lot of time. So, and it's a series of tweets. I think people need to know that this isn't just one tweet, but the one tweet that got all the attention was, "White evangelicals are the lone bulwark against moral insanity in America." Now, I think I should read the rest of it, but I don't think most people criticizing this did. So he then went on and said, instead of saying, "Yeah, but me too," why not say, "Yeah, white evangelicals have endured the accusations and made their bloc essential to moral sanity." Obviously, he's talking about voting there or cultural, resistance. "White evangelicalism is relentlessly attacked by the left and center right, but a guy says something positive about them and he's called racist. Weird. It's as if the establishment rhetorical norms require you to hate this group. It is simply true that white evangelicals as a group have been essential to the success of the GOP and conservative causes, and they remain the most reliable voters for those opposing woke and transgenderism." Now, it goes on a bit, and the point that I wanted to make, and I think, David, you pointed this out too, is he's not making it. This isn't a theological category he's talking about here. And I knew that as soon as he said it. This is a social category he's talking about.
Political category, right? I mean, you know,
sociopolitical, sure.
Yeah, in terms of it being used in the way that the secular world would use it. That's what I took from it. But I mean, I think I said something like it might have been unhelpful to not make that clear in the first tweet, but it really did. I mean, it really got people's gruff up immediately. Immediately people are tweeting and saying, "Well, there's no such thing as white evangelicals and black evangelicals." And it's like, yeah, okay, that's true. That's true. But if the world is using this framework, I'm not saying that somehow necessarily justifies it, but when we use that term, it has to be used. It's automatically, at least for me, automatically contextualized by the fact that Christians really don't use that term. The world uses that term.
Yeah.
That's what contextualizes it for me, at least.
I want to add,
and the thing is, Stephen and I would disagree about a whole bunch of things, right? I mean, me being much more of a Reformed Baptist and probably more committed to individual liberty as a moral imperative, especially in America. We would have disagreements, but the most important thing is we have to have common ground on which to have the debate, you know. And right now, the common ground isn't even there, right? It's we're standing on sand. Nobody can actually get their footing enough to actually have a good faith debate about the issue. I think.
Yeah, we're in the cloud of war right now, and things are very murky. I want to bring in, there's a bunch of people waiting here to ask a question or make a comment about this. So I'm just going to bring in Evan real quick. Evan, can you hear me? Are you there?
Hey, yeah, I'm here. I apologize. I actually did not have a question. I didn't realize it was in the queue. But thank you guys for doing this. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you can go to YouTube, you know, and stream it, or Facebook if you want, if you didn't want to ask a question. But it's good to hear from you. I'm glad you
good to be here.
Let's, Wolf. Wait, is this Stephen Wolf? All right, Wolf, I'm letting you in. William Wolf, Stephen Wolf, any other Wolf? Well, they're not.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm driving right now. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, it's Stephen Wolf. Yeah. Are you going to pull over or go home to an internet connection anytime? No, you're driving.
No, I'm not pulling over. If it's terrible, I'll just get out. Sorry.
No, it's not terrible. No, well, we were just talking about you, so.
Okay, good.
Well, so we were just talking about the reaction to this tweet that you put out there, and the series of tweets, really. And we haven't gotten into diagnosing exactly what's behind this yet and why the reaction, but we were at the point of saying that this is insane. Like, talk about straining at gnats and swallowing camels, and the lack of sense of proportion and the lack of giving any, charity benefit of the doubt to you. What do you think is going on?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's a thread, so you can check the whole meaning, and even in Twitter, I guess, you know, context matters given the full thread, which explains exactly what I was up to. I mean, the sad thing is that what it really comes down to is I had something positive to say about white evangelicals. I mean, this is a lot of the response you see from like James White and other guys, like there's no black and there's no white. Like, all right, there's no black and no white, but that these people have been suffered like an onslaught from the left and the center right for years, for decades. I mean, you have Dumez's, you may have you say, or the silly Jesus John Wayne book. The subtitle is how white evangelicals corrupted the faith. Right. So.
Right.
It's like these people have already been classified. You don't want to call them white evangelical, fine. Call them whatever you want. But there is a class of this group of people have been classified negatively. And so sociologically, they exist. You want to say it's not real, like cosmically, okay, fine. There doesn't cosmically exist white evangelicals, but there does exist sociologically this group called white evangelicals. And the only thing you're allowed to say is negative. But here I am, I say something positive, which is absolutely true, that if it wasn't for the voting behavior of white evangelicals, like if you just eliminated them, it would absolutely put the left, it would be worse than Canada. It would be an absolute disaster politically if we didn't have the white evangelical vote. And that's just true. But I'm saying something, I said something nice about white evangelicals, and that freaks them. That, you know, everyone loses their mind. But if this group actually exists sociologically, then why not say something positive that's actually true, you know? So there's more to all this, of course, but it's just a ridiculous response to say, oh, this is not like, this group is not real. Well, you know, it is real, and they've endured a lot. I mean, seriously, for years, they've been called, I remember there was like a Christianity Today article, there's spiritual darkness, and every single evangelical elite writes for the Gospel Coalition says, you know, things like, you know, it shows like the rotten fruit of, nationalism or something like that. And you just saw this repeatedly. But here's a group that held the line. Like you want to talk about like some of the successes of the conservatives over the last like 10, 20 years. And David French wants to say, yeah, we actually have had some success in the constitutional side of the courts. Like, okay, well, yeah, but why is that? Well, because of the voting behavior of white evangelicals. I mean, I know there are no white evangelicals on the court, but nevertheless, it was the voting behavior that was in place. Anyway. I'm ranting on, but I'll just leave it at that.
Well, it's a helpful rant. If you don't mind, I'd love to give you some. You probably have responded to some of these already, but the responses to you. One is that you should have said it better. You should have just. And actually, David just kind of he didn't say it exactly that way, but I think that's what you were saying, David. Is you could have phrased this better. You could have been more
only that clear. Maybe the political context could if it had been in the first tweet. But honestly, I mean that's not to blame you know Stephen for the I would argue the sort of hyperbolic responses that followed. You know, if the political context had been in the first tweet, probably not everybody would have ran to the keyboard to you know make sure that they're clear about everybody being you know there being no you know male or female Greek or Jew under Christ.
I had someone reach out to me today and text me and say that you know this is what you did, Stephen, was just they didn't say dumb, but that's really what they meant. Like this was careless. It was with everything you stand for.
Did Can't Impress say that?
Well, Can't Impress did. Yeah, we're gonna get to that tweet. Can't Impress said this is dumb. Yeah, the person who's texting me was just you know, and I might differ with you on this, David. I actually my initial reaction was I'm glad Stephen said what he did. I really am the way he did because. It exposed, in my opinion, a lot of people who some of them don't weigh in on things in general that are political. Others will weigh in sometimes, but not like this. And to see them all get set off, I think that's the shocking thing to me, to see how many people got set off so quickly. It was like a beehive and the bees were swarming. And you know, Stephen, I actually am thankful that you phrased it that way. I mean, would you rephrase it though, if you had to do it over? I think Stephen's on mute. I think you pushed your mute.
Yeah. I mean, if I had to redo it, I guess I would, but then, you know, I was between like, doing some kind of weird experimental quad lift, you know, lifting weights. So who knows, maybe the next set I would have said something different. Who knows?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, what about this?
Go
ahead.
But everyone's like freaking out about the loan part, but it's if you read the rest of the tweet, I understand like the first one by itself can kind of be confusing. I also think that people, I don't know, they don't understand the categories of social science, the white evangelicals, the standard, you know, sociological term, but the idea is that it's the lone group. Like in terms of groups, is there any other group that has withstood the sort of like attacks in the recent years, like in terms of like the regime's assault on them? It has endured, and votes Republican like 80-85%. So the tweet as I intended, I can understand how some people can take it differently. I also think you're right that it exposed people have like this sort of race brain. I've called it race brain for years, where they, like, once they get like some sense that something's racist, they literally lose their minds. Like they're incapable of thinking clearly, and they say things that are stupid. Like they have to, like literally you can't even break them free from their absurdity because they're so locked in this sort of race brain. Like, oh, that's racist. And so they say dumb stuff in reply. And that's why you read like a lot of the replies and everything. You just like, this is just, like, theologically, this is stupid and bonkers. And like, why would you think this actually deals with the issue? And don't you understand there's a, like there's just a thing like, oh, you can't divide the body of Christ. And like, well, do you understand, like, that's ecclesiology. Like, this is sociology. Like, do you understand there's like a difference? There is like a real thing in this discipline called white evangelical.
So one of the things was that people were critiquing there is, as you just rightly stated, that the theological category of who belongs in the church is transcends race, and therefore I'm trying to my best to understand this and to articulate it, but it sounds to me like most people believe that race actually is a social construct, even on the quote unquote conservative side. And they think that in the church, those, because there's unity in Christ theologically, which is absolutely true, then these cultural significant things that you're pointing out, shouldn't be pointed out. I don't know. But some of them will use, like, I found some tweets of some of these people criticizing you using the term black church. And it's just, I don't know what to make of that. Like, it's just, you can't say, I think what you said at the beginning, Stephen, is correct. Like, the rules are, you can't say anything positive about white evangelicals or white Christians. So, I mean, do you think there is a conflation of the theological category of being one in Christ, and then at the same time, the sociological thing, or they're unable to separate those two because of ideology or something?
Yeah, I mean, they're like, it's just this race brain thing where they start conflating theological, the ecclesiological categories with, you know, like social science categories. But I mean, like, you're absolutely right that there's like a sort of rhetorical double standard, like built in, like to our, I don't know, rhetoric, whatever you want to call it, where if you're gonna talk about like anything white, it has to be bad. And if you say anything good, it's racist. Or, you know, you shouldn't talk in terms of race. But then these same people talk about the black church, and they talk about white racism, and they talk about, so they'll deploy these categories when it's useful, and it's only useful in propping up, like, you know, whatever they want to label black, or to attack whatever they want to label white. Right? So there's, there is that sort of double standard. It's hypocritical, which is, you know, accusing things of hypocrisy is usually boring. But I mean, you have to understand that's like built in. So what happened here is like here, like I say something positive about a sociological category that uses the term white, and all these evangelicals like freak out that I'm now categorizing people by race, even though they've been doing it for years. And even the people who, you know, like they'll still say, even the people who are like anti-woke, they'll still say, you ask them, well, does racism still exist? They'll say, well, yes, there is. There are still some people who are racist against like blacks or whatever. Well, you're just, again, categorizing people by race. Like you're just deploying the categories whenever you find it expedient. But again, what I was doing is I'm saying, here's a group of people who've been classified by a term. I don't care what term you want to use, but that's the term that's used. And I'm going to say something positive about them, but they freak out because they're in their race-based brain, like rhetorical mind, you have to associate, like you have to universalize like the white or it's bad. You have to like, it has to, you can't actually say something good to the exclusion of anything that would be non-white. You do that, that's racist. But of course, you can do that for anyone who is non-white. Like you can praise all day long. Like you can say like African bishops are the lone bulwark maintaining the Anglican communion, whatever it is. You can say that all day long because you're not talking about white people. And again, I don't care. Like yeah, it's so generally like these are all like sociological constructs. But they still become real if after like years and years, a certain subset of the population are classified by the media, by academics, by our own like evangelical elites. I mean, Keller talks about white evangelicals. Russell Moore talks about white evangelicals. David French talks about white evangelicals. So of course, like it's been reified. It's been made a thing. And so you can then say, okay, if it is a thing and there are these people and they have this particular voting pattern that is good, well, then we should say that is good. You know, we can say that is good for that, you know, that population of people.
Yeah, no, I agree. Stephen, I don't know how much longer you have since you're driving right now. We got a few people that want to call in and maybe ask you a question, but I want to pitch it to you, David, since we do have Stephen unexpectedly with us on the stream. Is there anything you want to say or ask of Stephen?
Well, it seems like the sociological categories of white evangelical, black evangelical, they're used as kind of a cudgel against, I would argue, against enemies of the church and I mean the godless secular world and those that are trying to attack sound doctrine as like a bait and switch. And I was trying to explain this to a few of our Christian brothers who are, I mean, very much theologically aligned with us, who are African American, that the idea is when the world attacks white evangelicals, they're attacking the doctrine and the ideology and the theology behind that. And that includes all of our, ethnically diverse brothers and sisters in Christ that agree with us theologically. And when they say the black church, they're not really trying to promote or exalt or praise all black churches. They're trying to promote or exalt a specific theology that is just statistically more common in the black church. That's, you know, this is about ideas and doctrine and theology, even though we're looking at it through an abstraction. And I mean, guys like Russell Moore or David French or whoever are going to talk about this in terms of an abstraction. When they say, like when Kristen, you know, Kobe Dumez says, white evangelicals, she's saying conservative evangelicals. And it just happens that the correlation is that most of them in the United States are white people. The target is the doctrine, though. It's not the skin color.
Well, right. It's just that the culture from which this conservatism arises is a culture that is rooted in the Western tradition, specifically in our context, the Anglo-Western tradition. And I would think there'd be a reason that denominations that have come from that part of the world would also mirror political views that also come from that part of the world, and or at least were developed there.
There's a correlation. I mean, part of what I'm working on right now is that basically establishing this idea that there's an individualism that, because a lot of the folks that are really opposed, like in our theological circles, who are really opposed to the some of the ideas of Christian nationalism, and I mean they're worried about the elimination of individual liberty and things like this, but there is a brand of individualism that is rooted straight out of the Protestant Reformation that is distinct and different from Enlightenment individualism that I think is really important that we discuss at some point, because that it forms some of the common ground, I think, between the two camps in this argument.
If you can find common ground, David, I will give you $100. if you can bring these sides together. Becca, if you want to turn your mic on, I'm going to add you to the stream. We have a bunch of people online, so I need to get to them. We have Stephen Wolf with us right now. And so I would, since he's the one who created the tweet that's getting all the attention, if you have a question for him, now would be the time. So, Becca, I don't know if you're able to turn your microphone on, but if you are, we will come to you. In the meantime, let's add John to the stream. John, if you can turn your microphone on, take it off the mute, then we'll come to you. I think this is hard for some people, David. I don't know. What do you use? Do you use the same program I do, the StreamYard?
No.
Okay. Nope. I've noticed that sometimes the people who use Zoom, when they come onto StreamYard, it can be a little difficult.
Yeah, it's the browser settings. You got to go into, like, when you pull up StreamYard in your browser, make sure that you go to the settings and choose the right microphone, right, and choose the right camera and all that. It's a little setup.
Well, if Becca and John, if you guys want to take your microphone mute off, I will come back to you. Ed Sanders is ready. Ed, of course, but your microphone, if you could turn that on, your video's there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah. How you doing?
Actually, I didn't have a question. I just logged in a few minutes ago saw that notification in my email and thought, well, I better get in on this and see what everybody's talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now you know.
So you're saying hi to the whole internet right now.
You are. Everyone's here to say hi. Well, good to see you, Ed.
So I'm just one thing, though, on Christian nationalism, and I've heard all kinds of just lost my earbud. I've heard lots of different views on it, and it's still not completely clear what that definition is to me.
Well, I think that's a question, Stephen. I think you just got a question. What's the definition of Christian nationalism for someone who's not clear on exactly what it is?
I can try to answer that. Yeah, I mean, my definition is, to put it simply, is that there's a nation, or you have a group of Christians who are self-conscious of them being a sort of Christian nation. They understand themselves collectively as a Christian nation, and so they act to order themselves to both their earthly and heavenly good. So they arrange themselves with social customs and civil law that will not just facilitate them having good lives and good vocations here and now, but also points them to heaven as well. So that, you know, that would involve like customs and laws. And, that's why it's very kind of broad, and it could look very different in different places. So if you mean by that, like, what's the American project, I mean, that's kind of a different question for, it's kind of an application of the definition, but that's my definition. So again, it's just it's a Christian nation that understands itself as such, or as a Christian people, and they essentially tell themselves, well, we're going to arrange and order ourselves for our good, which includes the highest good or Christian good. That's
pretty general. I mean, does that answer your question, Ed?
Well, I guess kind of begs the question, where are we going when you hear the secular media talk about Christian nationalism? They're of course, they view it in negative light, and they think that Christians are going to try and take over the country and push their religion on us. That's what they want to do. So as Christians...
So what concretely would that look like, though? I'm sorry to cut you off, Ed, but maybe if we can get concrete with our examples, it would help with this. So the nightmare scenario you're describing in the media, what do you think they're most afraid of? That like Christians will take their abortion rights, or that they'll force everyone to go to church, or like what is it you think? Just your impression, I guess, is what I'm asking. What do you think the big fear is? I was asking Ed.
Oh, I'm sure.
I was just wondering if you could make what you were saying more concrete.
I think the non-Christians have this fear that we're going to push our morality on them. And take over the government, and dictate to them what our religious views. But
so violate our freedom of conscience. It sounds like
But what is it exactly? Are we trying to do other than vote for a Christian, say, representative or something? What else can we do? I mean, and don't forget to pray, but really, what else are we going to do?
That's a good question.
Create a new party that nobody will vote for. But
okay. So that's like three questions. Let's pitch that to Stephen. Stephen, are you trying to create another party? And what do you think about this concern that Christian nationalism would violate freedom of conscience?
Yeah, I'm kind of can you hear me okay now?
I can hear you.
It's probably better now. Yeah, I mean, we're getting into kind of the movement question, which I'm frankly not good at. but that's, what are we doing now is a good question. What do we do? I think we're still kind of in the planning, sorting things out stage. In terms of like freedom of conscience, I mean, I mean, if the secular elite are afraid of Christian nationalism, I mean, that's good because it actually does threaten their power. I mean, because I think we've learned that there is no coexistence with these people. They are there to win and to dominate and to exclude. And so there's no coexistence. So, I mean, if the secular elite are scared, I mean, I think it's nowadays a little performative. But for their own, like it's a rhetorical device. And but if they are legitimately scared, I mean, that's kind of rational for them to be so. I mean, in my view, and we should see that as a good sign, because I mean, yeah, if you want like abortion rights and gay rights, and you want to exclude Orthodox Christians from institutions. We're going to push back on that because I mean, Christian nationalism is essentially Christianizing the institutions, and which to my mind is excluding people who would prevent that. And now how we get there, of course, is a very complicated, difficult question to answer. I usually, my kind of stock answer is that, well, things change quickly. Sometimes I mentioned that in the 1760s, few people thought that the United States would be in a war, with the crown, let alone, declaring independence. Now, I'm not saying we need to go into a revolution, but just the point being that within a few short years, things change rapidly. And so it's good to be thinking about these sort of things beforehand. I think we should be kind of clear about the goal. Someone asked me recently, I mean, another same similar questions, like, aren't these people like these, what do we say to the people who like are scared of Christian nationalism? Like, well, why are they scared? I mean, they're scared because their dominance of the institutions is diametrically opposed to ours. And so if we were to have power, they would have to be excluded. I know that sounds like I don't know what people dictatorial, but we're already under that. But anyway,
I want to pitch it to Evan since he's been waiting patiently. And thank you, Stephen, for weighing in on that. Evan, did you have a question for Stephen or just a point you wanted to make?
Yeah, I did. So one of the things I was thinking about as I was watching all of this blow up on Twitter this past week was I was remembering back to 2018 and when the statement on social justice came out. And at the time, I wasn't as aware of a lot of the voices on the right, but I was like, finally, somebody's addressing this. And then I read through it and I was like, well, actually, there's a fair amount of stuff in here that I disagree with. I was always kind of to the right of where a lot of the G3 guys were on some of this, but I was like, you know what, I'm going to put that aside. I'm going to share this. I'm going to really put a lot of effort behind, you know, sharing this with my friends and stuff, because I was willing to compromise in order to address that issue. And I think you're seeing a lot of the same issues come up again now a few years later, but what you're seeing is the sort of the left-hand side of that is not willing to compromise with those of us to the right. And I think in some ways the way that the social justice issue was addressed makes it harder now, because a lot of these people really don't understand what critical race theory is. And, you know, there's sort of this idea that critical race theory is racism, right? Or that it somehow is racialism. when, you know, in reality, you know, one of the sort of the fundamental tenets of CRT is that races don't exist, that it's completely a social construct. And so I think that's where sort of this accusation against Stephen is coming from, that, oh, he's just, you know, woke, but on the right. That sort of thing. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about that, Stephen? Like, maybe does some of this arise from the way that the social justice controversy was addressed back in like 2018?
Yeah, I'll just say straight up. I mean, I think that the like evangelical anti-wokeness over the last few years has really just made evangelicals dumber. Maybe I should say dumb. I don't know. Maybe that's not fair, but it's made people like incapable of actually looking at the way society, the hierarchy of society right now, you know, so they want to claim that no, there are not these like racial hierarchies with that have oppressed non-whites. They want to say that. And so they critique the very idea that's possible. No, of course that's not. But then you have today where our institutions are pretty explicitly like anti-white. I mean, it's just obvious that they are. But now we don't actually have the means to say it. And if someone says it, well, then they've committed a CRT. This is not like identifying like scientific racism or biological realities. It's just being able to analyze the basic society that we live in today, which does have a sort of new racial hierarchy that we have to contend with. I mean, this is why a lot of people on the right love Tucker Carlson, because he at least hints at the idea that no, like, it's not hypocrisy, it's hierarchy. Like, the reason why the left treats you differently than these other people is because of a racial hierarchy. I think that the anti-CRT kind of movement, and I think in justifiably pointing out really the nonsense that is within left-wing CRT, has then eliminated like this ability for us to actually see the world as it is. It's like imported this ideology that makes it impossible to look at things. It's like, you know, and they give like, they have like these stock answers. Like, it's the same. It's like to my tweet, like, you know, Strand James White will respond like, there's no right, there's no race, there's no white, black, and this in the church, and that's run all that. But I mean, but like, sociologically, that exists. It's true. It's a sociological fact or a social fact. But we've just been rendered incapable of actually seeing these things. That's, again, they're not true cosmically, but they are true socially. And like, that's, you know, we live in society, so it's real. It's real enough for us in life. So I that's a long answer. I guess the short answer is yes, I do think that like the social justice statement and all those people surrounded of that, like, really set us up to just be dumb and be like incapable of seeing the, you know, the hierarchies that are being in place, like before our eyes. Like we have to, it's like we have to start believing absurd. Like we can't actually, we have to like import this, this ideology that, that really conceals like what's right in our face.
I feel that. I think we all feel that to an extent, that there's obvious truths and you say them and you're called the extremist or you're called dangerous. You're called all these names, but they're, it's our life. It's every day that many of us see some of these things. Regarding the statement on social justice, I want to pitch it to you in a minute, David, just to give you a forewarning. When that first came out, I noticed, I think, what you were talking about, Evan, which is the language in it that suggested race is a social construct. It might even say that. I can't remember the exact phrasing. And that's, I think, one of the things that has set my critique of social justice apart from some, and maybe others as well, not just me. I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but I know that that was one of the things I saw as a problem that many of the other big names in evangelicalism who are fighting wokeness, quote unquote, did not see, or at least if they saw it, they disagreed with my assessment of that. And they really did adopt this element of critical race theory, that race is a social construct. And they use that in their critique of critical race theory to then, I think, give the impression that CRT is simply racism. It's a reverse kind of racism, and that it believes in racial categories too much. And of course, racial categories are at least categories of ethnicity. We'll use the biblical, the Greek word ethnos or nations. These categories are inescapable. That's just part of our life. We can't emancipate ourselves from the world God has created. He's created it this way. And in his providence, there's a certain order to it. And so anyway, I signed the Dallas statement just like you did, Evan, but I've tried in my critiques and my books to make it clear that I think it's a mistake if we start going down that path of race is just a social construct. It's clearly not. David, I know you were pretty supportive of the Dallas statement. I mean, what do you think about that critique?
Well, to say that race is a social construct entirely is obviously not true, you know, in and of itself. The question is, you know, what problem do we get into when we start blurring the lines between our understanding of the race of Christ and the race of Adam, the new nation that is of believers, of the invisible church, we could call it, or the universal church even, versus the social constructs and national constructs and things of the fallen world that we live in. It doesn't do anybody any good to pretend like reality doesn't exist. Like I've heard people argue that Galatians 3:28, you know, there's no male nor female, there's no Jew nor Greek, you know, nor slave or master, these kind of things under Christ means that all earthly distinctions like this are wiped away, which is ridiculous, obviously. And they're usually using it to try to wipe away gender roles, to try to say that, to try to support egalitarianism. But it's, I would argue it's unhelpful and sometimes used as a crutch and a sort of a defense mechanism and a way for especially guys of my theological stripe, you know, Baptist, to sort of pull back from the culture war and almost, you know, get real radical about two kingdoms theology and say, now we don't have to do anything. You know, it's not really, we don't have to actually engage in the hot button social and cultural problems of the day because, you know, we're only focused on the kingdom and we're going to save people and therefore we can disengage from all these other things. And that's just, I don't think that that's biblically supportable. It's certainly not historical, you know, Protestant or Reformation doctrine in any way.
Yeah.
Well, let me say too, just as like an example of this,
please,
and how it makes us dumb, is like, just take, I know this is a very fashionable and common, it sounds pious and spiritual and all that, but like when James White said something to the effect of, you know, I have more in common with the Chinese peasant and paddy fields than I do with the, you know, secular white neighbor next door or something like that. Well, that's just absurd. I'm sorry. Like that, you don't speak the same language. You don't have the same customs. You don't have the same like family arrangements. You can't do anything together because you can't communicate or you don't understand each other. You don't have the same mutual expectations. I mean, it's just absurd to think that you have more in common. I mean, you share the highest good. I mean, he's talking about like, you know, the Christian Chinese man. You share the highest good in common with that person. But that doesn't mean that because you share like the ultimate goal, which is eternal life, that therefore within temporal matters, you know, within the things of this world, which are essential for life, that you can actually get along better than other people. I mean, think of like even though like James Lindsay and I would probably get in a fight if we saw each other, he and O'Fallon can work together because O'Fallon's a Christian, Lindsay is an atheist, but they speak the same language, they have the same interests. They could talk about the same TV shows they want. They could, you know, complain about Biden all they want all day. They can both hate Christian nationalism. I mean, imagine like O'Fallon going out to China and he's like, yeah, there's this guy named Wolf and he likes Christian nationalism. It's a really bad idea. But the Chinese guy would be like, what are you talking about, dude? Like, I mean, he wouldn't even say that because they couldn't speak the same language. So it's just like, you know, I'm kind of rambling on, but it's just dumb. Like,
well, it's an error of conflating the visible church, the local church, the gathering of the body in a specific place with the universal church, right? And the universal church and all regenerate believers around the world is a reality, but it's not something that can be exercised practically in the way that we can love our neighbors and love our fellow church members. You know, that becomes a problem because we say, okay, the first commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. The second is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. Well, who is my neighbor? Well, the people closest to me, and then it works out from there. So my family, my church, my community, these are people I can practically love. And while, yes, salvifically and in terms of my regeneration, yes, I have more in common with the Chinese Christian than I do with the pagan that lives next door to me. I'm not saying my next door neighbors are pagans, but you get my point. But in terms of loving your neighbor, I have a much better chance, you know, like you said, of practically loving those who are closest to me. And that's where it all starts. But if I piously say, well, I have more in common with other Christians around the world, I kind of get myself off the hook for actually having to do anything, you know, in terms of practically loving, practically sharing the gospel, practically serving those closest to me in a material way that opens up the door to be able to share the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
You know, and Baptists, I mean, you know this, John, Baptists are like more uniquely guilty of this little bait and switch, you know?
Yeah, it's very pious sounding if you can say, like, I have much in common with a Nigerian, you know, Christian woman than I do my neighbor who's not a Christian, but we listen to the same music, go to the same places, have the same experiences, ancestry, lineage, whatever. It sounds really good because I think what, I don't know, Stephen, you might have a thought on this, but I came to the conclusion recently, I think I've thought this for a while, but it became more clear in my mind. That there's a pathology among Europeans, specifically Anglo peoples, because I noticed it during the monument craze, and that's still going on. But when it started, what countries were the most aggressive towards tearing down their own monuments, their own history? Obviously, here in the United States. Another place was South Africa. Another place was Great Britain. Those are probably the three places that had the most issues with this issue movement. And it strikes me as odd that, I mean, this is something that in the history of the world, I can't think of good examples. I mean, communist countries taking down what was before them, or, you know, French Revolution trying to start at year zero or something. I mean, those are the nearest examples that I can come up with. But this is even more deep and pathological. This is, it's almost a hatred of home, a hatred of personal lineage in some cases. I mean, I remember it was like the great, great, great grandson or something of I think it might've been Robert E. Lee. It was one of these generals saying, oh yeah, my dad's, my great, great granddad's statue should come down. Right. It's like, who are you? Like this is our history. So I didn't want to sidetrack to the monument issue. That was just one of the indications to me that there's something deeply pathological among Europeans. And it's, I don't know that the pietist explanation that I keep hearing, well, they're, you know, they're just pietists and that's why they don't want to be involved in the civic arena. Maybe that factors in. I'm sure it does, but I'm seeing this in every institution. It's not just the church. It's this unwillingness to defend oneself, unwillingness to fight, to assert oneself. And then the moral goodness is when you give up power, give up privilege, when you share, when you have a closeness with those who you're actually not close with, but you love difference. And it's an obsession. And I don't exactly know where this comes from. And Stephen, I'll start. I don't know if David has a thought on this, but Stephen, let me start with you. Where does this come from? Do you agree with me, first of all, that this is a pathological issue?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. I think that, so this one sociologist named Eric Kaufman, he coined it, a term called asymmetric cosmopolitanism. I think there's a National Review article that he talks about this. It's asymmetric cosmopolitanism, which basically says that anyone who's, you know, quote unquote white, I say that because of course there's what we classify as white actually contains, you know, dozens of ethnicities and subgroups and all that. But anyway, under white, quote, I have my fingers up, they are expected to not have themselves any sort of culture or ethnicity. They are just individuals. And if they do have a culture, it's bland and boring. And so they cannot be self-affirming. But the asymmetrical part is that while white people are expected, both by themselves and everyone else, to have this cosmopolitanism, they cannot expect it of anyone else, which means that anyone who's essentially classified as non-white have full rights to their ancestral or their ethnicity, have a self-affirming group identity, and can it even be kind of recognized in official documents and government forms and all that sort of thing. Whereas white people don't have an ethnicity. They're classified as other. In fact, I just saw an army document that has requires each soldier to have a reclassify themselves by race and ethnicity. And they have race, so it's white. But if you open up ethnicity, they have everything from like Filipino to Eskimo to Japanese, but they don't have Italian, they don't have Irish, they don't have German, they don't have Anglo, they have other. So if you are white, you are white other.
Well, they've created an abstraction out of us.
Yes, that's what you are. You are like an abstract individual, and your only good is essentially to facilitate other people's self-group identity, their group identity. So you're not allowed to have a group identity. That's not to say like, oh, well, we ought to have white nationalism or a white nation or a white ethnostate, but it's to say that if you're like Italian, you're really not allowed to have anything except some sort of like boutique ethnicity. Or like if you're Irish, you can have fun on St. Patrick's Day, you know, and joke about getting drunk or whatever, but you can't actually have this self-affirming identity as an Irishman. And you see this in Ireland today. What is Ireland? Ireland is literally like replacing itself with foreigners as we speak, by the same logic, which is like that they're essentially importing asymmetric cosmopolitanism from the United States, which is where it originated. That's my explanation for what's happening. It's hard to know how to respond to that, because if like white people start saying no, well, then their only recourse is essentially a sort of white nationalism, which I think is a dead end. So it's hard to know, like, how do you, other than just not try not to play the game? I don't exactly respond to it. And I think it's very hard not to play the game, and I get in trouble for it. That's my thought. Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
No, you're good. I was at a conference over the weekend for the Appable Institute, which is kind of a smaller academic organization. And their whole goal is to preserve what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition, which is the Jeffersonian tradition. And And so, you know, very pro-Southern. There's people there from all over the place. But one of the speeches, one of the guys who was giving a speech there said that we have to resist this urge. And he's talking to Southerners in particular. If Southerners need to resist the urge to just be thought of as white or Trump country, to be made an abstraction or a caricature, and that the solution to the people who want to vilify white people and then Southerners as like the most, the worst form of white people or something, is to, it sounds cliche, but to love, you know, the response to hate is to love. And he said, you just have to love your place, love the church down the road, get involved locally with anything you can. Make sure you're putting time into your kids. You're teaching them. You're giving them a dose of what they're not going to get at school. So they know their history. They know where they came from. They have an identity that's strong. That's what you got to do. And it is hard work. And it takes all of us to work in this way. And I would say that to anyone. I don't care where you came from. I know later this week, I live in a very diverse area now. And the church I go to is particularly diverse. And he'll probably listen to this podcast. I'm not going to say his name, but I'm going to be helping for the first time in a pastoral internship doing marriage counseling with someone from, well, their family goes back to Jamaica, and then they're marrying someone whose family, I believe they go back to Haiti, if I'm not mistaken. And so these two people are getting married, and I would say to them the same thing. Right? It's not like this is unique to Southerners or white people or anyone. I would say you have a responsibility to love where you are, and the things that are in proximity to you is where you're going to devote your time. And that's the only way to fight these people who want to make everything an abstraction, push it all through ideology, put labels on everything, whether it's good or bad, if it conforms to that ideology. And it's to say, no, that life is more complicated than that. Life is more beautiful than that. God made it that way for a reason. And we can appreciate true diversity. So that's just my little soapbox. And that's my solution. I know it's not like it's a big government, let's take it over kind of solution, although that would be great. But it's each of us have to start where we're at with what we have. So... any thoughts? You haven't said anything for a while, David. Any thoughts on any of that?
Hey, let me jump in and say I got to run, but thanks for letting me jump in.
Yeah, thank you, Stephen. Hey, it was unexpected, but very appreciated. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Bye.
Well, it's. I mean, like we said before, that's the practical outworking of all of this is really what matters, because we live in an information age where, you know, like if I said, hey, the industrial age really started to separate people from place, you know, with mass transport, right, and mass media starts to become a thing. The information age has separated people from their own body, almost their own like physical existence where they are. And so it's really easy in our affluent society where we use the information technology to craft our own reality. It's really easy in that framework to throw out silly claims like, you know, true love of neighbor is loving everybody around the world equally, as if that's somehow possible.
Point.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's easy for us to say that piously on Twitter or whatever without really, you know, figuring out, does that even work? Does that even make any sense? And so it's, you know, like for instance, we have wonderful, you know, like folks on the chat right here that I know are like patrons of Conversations That Matter and patrons of Protestia, even, you know, places, you know, and we love them, and that's wonderful, but there's no chance that I can practically love them the way that I can practically love my own family, my own church, the people nearby. And that it doesn't matter what their ethnic background is. They're the people that God has put in my sphere. And so to the best of my ability, I'm going to love them the best I can in accordance with what Jesus taught us. It's not as complicated as we're making it out to be. And like for me as an American, yes, that involves exercising the liberty God has granted me and the governing role he has granted me as a participant in self-government, you know, and that's where I think some of that common ground has to come to bear with regard to the common ground between the two sides of this debate is like, you know, there's the practical outworking of this. There's the strategic outworking of this. Like, you know, for instance, people are asked, okay, do we even use the term Christian nationalist because it's been so tainted by the world? It's been set up as a trap. You know, they call January 6th the big Christian nationalist thing. Right. And that's a debate worth having. But we have to start by getting that common ground figured out and realize that in so many of these instances, we're just talking past each other.
You know, yeah. Which is why we have to be careful to try to give the benefit of the doubt where we can and try to at least understand. Our goal should be understanding. David, check this out. I don't know if you saw this. This just happened. But Ali Beth Stuckey apparently weighed in on this whole issue in favor of Stephen. She says, this tweet is floating around Christian Twitter and people I highly respect are pushing back against it. I've never read anything by Wolf, but this tweet by itself seems to me to be obviously be talking about the fact that statistically white evangelicals as a block are the most conservative. So that's how I took it. I think that's how you took it. And that's right. How Ali Beth Stuckey is taking it. She's a little bit of a bigger name in this. But Simply Grace wanted me to share that. And so I'm sharing it. We've been going a little over an hour. So I think we're going to land the plane here. I know you just said a bunch, David, which was good. Any final thoughts you want to share before we close?
For everybody who's watching, a prayer for me while I put the article together I'm working on. I'm trying to, like I said, find the common ground here, and maybe people will be like, we don't care what David from Protestia says about the common ground for this, but if nothing else, you know, our place in the ecosystem is sometimes to provide the intellectual or research firepower that bigger names and, you know, like more respectable types will use to forward the conversation. So
yeah, I'm grateful for what you do. The attempt. Yeah, I think many of us are grateful for what you do, David, and I know you take a lot of shots for it. So I just want to say, you know, I appreciate it, and this isn't even your full time job or anything.
No,
this is a labor of love on your
part. It is definitely a labor of love,
which I so appreciate. And like I said, I mean, I just did taxes right last week, and so I don't have like any money. But I will give you $100 if you could. It's not much, but
hold on. Hold on to that for sure. It's the more solid and not only solid, but authentic voices that we have in this, you know, because it costs everybody. It costs you something personally to be John Harris that people know and on the internet and things like, I think I told you this before, I've had folks at my church come up to me and other pastors and say, is it okay that we're listening to John Harris conversations about matter? Like, yeah, it's okay. That's a good source.
They probably heard that someone say it's dangerous or something.
It's possible. You know, it just because you've been such a respectable voice for years now in conservative circles, that's, you know, we always need more of that, of course.
Absolutely, brother. Yeah, I'm just going to share what I've been thinking about for a few days, but it's really, I think, just pertinent right now. I'm thankful for Stephen, and for a very simple, I mean, I'm thankful for him for more than this, but there's a very simple reason right now I'm thankful for him. And that is whether or not you agree with his book. And I've read it. I've taken a lot of notes. I interviewed him a number of times. So I've tried my best to understand where he's coming from. Whether you agree or not, he's moving the needle. And he's moving the needle, I think, in a direction that's good. He's raising questions that haven't been asked. He's challenging evangelical elites in ways that they haven't been challenged. And they need to be challenged on these matters. We need to be thinking about how our Christian witness affects our political and social life, how it should. Is power a good or a bad thing? Should we be seeking that in the temporal realm? These are all worthwhile discussions to have. And Christians used to have them. I think even the framework that Stephen brings that he's getting in trouble for now, which is that he acknowledges there are distinctions among people. This was just assumed for centuries up until about 5 seconds ago. This would have been universal. Read just about any dead Christian guy out there and you're going to find the theology is going to be very similar to, or the ideas are going to be very similar to the way Stephen is conceiving of the world. And for that reason alone, I'm thankful that he's bringing some of these things up and exposing, in my opinion, too. There are some people that have been, I think, embarrassed, perhaps, but exposed through their reaction, their over-the-top reaction to some very simple truths. Whether you agree with Stephen or not, I think he's doing a great service here. And I just want to say that, Stephen's not on here to... to hear me say this, but maybe he'll hear it later. And, you know, Stephen, if you do hear this, you know, I just want to encourage you, even having your own publishing company push back on you for this, but you're not backing down, and we need more examples of that. And I know, I'm sure David, you agree with that, that we need more examples of people like John MacArthur who don't back down. They say what they believe, and, you know, they're not arrogant about it, but if they have a conviction, they stick by it. I'm so sick of seeing people that without convictions, without consistency, who don't stick by things. I think Stephen's going to be a real leader moving forward just because of that bravery.
It's probably my biggest pet peeve right now is with what I term Christian institutionalists, who, you know, they what they say or how they say it or when they say it or who they target versus who they don't target is all based on, it's based less off of theological principle and more based off of this idea of maintaining the reputation of the institution, you know, maintaining their own position. And it's real sneaky. They do this by way of saying our institution promotes the gospel, and often it very much does. Therefore, anything that might negatively affect our institution is against the gospel ministry. It's a little bait and switch, which just happens to also correspond with what is in their self-interest. But yeah, it drives me up a wall.
Yeah, no, same. That's my biggest pet peeve too, I think. Well, David, thank you so much. Protestia.com, if you want to support the ministry that David's involved with there, and you want to read the article he's working on writing. And I just appreciate everyone being here for the live stream. More coming later this week. God bless.
Thanks, John.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.